Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency Weekend podcast. I'm Dion Fanning. The car bomb that killed Daria Dugina in Moscow may well have been intended for her father, Alexander Dugin, who was supposed to be riding in that car. Dugin is the father of Russian nationalism, or one of its fathers. His closeness or otherwise to Vladimir Putin is disputed. His relevance is disputed. And the people are person behind the killing of Daria Dugina is also disputed. It's something we talked to Johnny O'Reilly about today. Johnny has written about Ukraine. He's based in Kiev. He's written about Ukraine for The Currency many times, and he's broadcast podcasts for ourselves and for Eamon Dunphy and for other people as well. And he lived in Moscow for a number of years before moving to Kiev, so he knows and understands Russian nationalism. So we talked to him about Dugin, that importance in the Russian psyche, what he does for Putin. There is some suggestion that Putin himself may have been behind this killing, because Dugin may have been seen as somebody who's becoming a nuisance. He's encouraging more and more extremism from Putin in the war in Ukraine. And we talked to Johnny about that war as well, because it has reached a stalemate. Johnny has been on the front line researching a documentary, and it is a vast front line stretching across a huge part of Ukraine. And we wanted to talk to him about that front line, where the war is going and how it will end. Johnny, as we're speaking, it's the day after Ukraine's Independence Day. Can you tell us what how the country marked that on Wednesday, and also detail some of the violence and attacks by Russia that were designed clearly to coincide with that day?
Well, following the very successful recent attacks on military positions in Crimea by Ukraine, and also the assassination of Daria Dugina in Moscow, everyone was expecting some uptick, an escalation, and particularly on this day, which marks 31 years of Ukrainian independence, knowing that in the past, Putin had often chose particular days and dates to commit to a kind of a military or political action. Everyone expected there to be some big spectacular attack in particularly in Kiev. And there had been quite a lot of military movement north of the Belarusian border near Kiev. So people expected, because more rocket, artillery positions had been moved into firing range of Kiev, that Kiev was going to see a lot of fireworks yesterday. But that wasn't really the case. So yes, there was a terrible, tragic attack on a train near Dnipro, in which 25 people, I think, so far have died. The city of Kiev did suffer one rocket attack. There might have been many rockets which were sent over, but the anti-aircraft system around Kiev is so strong now that very few attacks have even been made in the last few months. But the big spectacular attack that people were expecting didn't happen yesterday. That doesn't mean to say that it won't happen in the coming days. But people are expecting some form of an escalation, particularly following the successful attacks on military positions in Crimea.
And how have Ukrainian people marked a day, and has it underlined their resolve about the war? Because you say it's 31 years, but it's also marked 6 months since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And as somebody who's been there and around the country that whole time, how do you feel the Ukrainian people's resolution is 6 months on?
Well, the morale of Ukrainians, both troops on the front line and everyday Ukrainians you meet in the street, it's undimmed. There's been no evidence really to convince them that their path is towards defeat. The path looks more towards victory, or at least some form of a long-term stalemate. So the morale is high. Yesterday was marked most visually by what the Zelensky administration have shown quite adept at doing quite a lot in providing a very compelling visual metaphor of the Russian tanks on the main street, the equivalent of O'Connell Street, if you like, in Kyiv. So the Russians did originally believe that they were going to take Kyiv very quickly within a few days, and that they would conduct some form of a Russian parade over time once they had control over the city. So Zelensky and his team are former filmmakers. They understand media very well, and they understand how to make a splash with a strong visual comment. So what they've done is they've collected dozens of smashed up, blown up, burnt out tanks and armored personnel vehicles and laid them all out along Kreshchatyk, O'Connell Street, in the manner of a parade. So it is a parade of Russian tanks, but they're all blown to pieces. So visually, that's quite stunning. And predictably, that's been the image that's been sent around the world. Zelensky did a piece to camera, quite a rousing speech that was pre-recorded on the morning of the 24th, of him walking along those tanks and marking the moment in history and delivering a very compelling speech, in my view, about where they are at the moment, and quite an inspiring vision for the continuing defiance and empowering of their military towards victory.
And is there any concern about how the spirit and resolution of the rest of Europe might be dimmed or undimmed? Because it's been noticeable that Macron has tried to tell French people to, you know, hunker down for the energy crisis this winter by saying, you know, this is a small price to pay in solidarity with Ukraine. Boris Johnson reappeared from one of his many holidays in the last couple of days, visited Ukraine, and also made a similar point to the British people. But is there a concern that as we head into winter, that and the war goes on, that unity will be harder to kind of keep together?
Well, I've certainly noticed that the government spokespeople and the different ministers are all singing the same tune and have been since the start of the war. If you remember, you know, for a long period, the big story was we need heavy weapon. But for a start, it was like we need to close the skies. We need, the provision of fighter jets in order to close the skies. They didn't achieve that, but their big storyline was they need the provision of heavy weaponry. Now the flow of heavy weaponry is quite solid, and the government ministers and spokespeople are not calling for that anymore. But what they are all now saying in unison is to keep the narrative alive, keep the story alive, in order to prevent international audiences and international governments from fatigue. You know, there is obviously a fear that governments in the autumn, in the winter, will suffer from Ukraine fatigue, and that could end up being advantageous for Putin in his negotiations over what are now quite a wide range of elements, including the provision of food, the nuclear problem around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear station, the war itself, and also the lifting of sanctions. So across a range of different processes, Putin is banking on international fatigue to deliver him some a better negotiated deal in one or other of those processes.
And what is the reality? Because you've talked about how Ukraine have created these arresting visual images, but you have also been in war zones on the front line, Johnny. And you might talk to us a little bit about what you've seen recently, because the war from the Western point of view has become a kind of a stalemate in many ways. But you've been on the front line. Like, what is the reality of what is happening in various places across the country?
Yeah, the war is a stalemate at the moment. But if you step back and look at the trajectory of how the war has evolved, say, over 6 months, Russia has, from month one, been increasing its control over a larger amount of territory. And then that basically came to an end about a month ago. And now they're not really increasing in territory in any directions. But what has happened simultaneously to that is that the provision of heavy weaponry from the West has built up Russian, Ukrainian army almost to a parity with the Russian army. And one would imagine that that could end up, in 6 months, in another 6 months' time, being more than just parity. So obviously different military analysts have different predictions, but most of the predictions are for Ukraine to reclaim some of its territory, and many predictions are for a stalemate, but there are very few predictions that Russia will increase substantially, increase the amount of land it's gained.
And what have you seen on your journeys outside Ukraine, outside Kyiv, then, in terms of that?
Well, I'm making a documentary in the south of the country called Return to Kherson. I'm embedded with a couple of different battalions, many of whom have soldiers from the city of Kherson, which is a city of about 300,000 people. It was the first major city to fall to the Russians and the only city over which there wasn't a major battle. So there are still about 100,000 people living there under Russian occupation. And the obviously a lot of them are under extreme stress. This is one of the towns where this mooted fake referendum campaign is about to start. But what I've seen across the whole span of this front line, which stretches 1,000 miles from the northeast of the country down to the southeast of the country, is probably a couple of 100,000 troops on either side, on both sides of the line. When you visit these places, Dion, you get a real sense of the topography of the way things are organized, which you don't really get from reading about in a paper. So the land in this part of the country and throughout the whole of Ukraine is actually very different to any land that you can imagine in most of Europe. And this is probably a legacy from the Soviet Union, when you had all these huge collective farms. So there's no such thing as a small farm in this country, and there's no such thing as a small field. So most of the fields are about one square mile. You might have some that are 2 or 3 square miles, but you don't see the kind of fields that you see in Ireland. So when you're near the front lines, you're driving typically along a road. On one side, you might have a field of wheat that's all already been cut. And on the other side, you might have a field of sunflowers. And they seem to stretch right to the horizon, because we Irish people, we're used to small little family-owned farms. It's unusual for us to see these things. But in these fields, between these fields, there's usually a kind of, like on the map, it looks like a little tuft of hedge grow. But in reality, it could be anything from 30 meters to 100 meters of forest. And these are the positions that all the heavy weaponry takes during the summertime, when there's coverage from the foliage. And these are the places where the trenches are built. So the frontline trench is essentially a hedgerow of anything from 30 to 100 meters wide, facing a giant wheat or barley field, across which, or across two or three fields, of which is the enemy position in a similar range. So that would be the like the front line. And the front line trenches are about like 2 meters deep. They tend to have been built longer than the second or the third line trenches. You would never have a high concentration of soldiers in one spot, because they're all taking artillery and various different mortars from the enemy. So the rule is that, you know, you might have one soldier every 5 meters or something like that. But as you walk along the kind of warren of these trenches, you know, they built little, what they call one bedroom and two bedroom apartments, but they're basically little hovels with enough space for one or two people to live. You might have a little space where they've put together a little round table, an area for cooking. So, you know, some of these trenches, which have been there for months, are very domesticated. Some of them have cats and dogs.
And are the soldiers there for months as well? Have they been moving? Have they been entrenched, so to speak?
They're there for months. You know, I remember, like, you know, I would meet characters from the local town, like they live maybe only like 30 minutes drive away. And, you know, ask them, do you go back for weekends? Like, no, I haven't been back for 3 months, you know. So it's a very strict, you know, it's like Irish college, except a lot worse. You know, you can't go home at the weekends. They're very strict about all of that. So once you're in the army, you're stuck. And if you leave, you're desert. You can't even, it's not like a job that you can leave from. You sign a 3-year contract and you just take orders. You go where you're told to go.
But those lines aren't moving significantly either then in a lot of places.
No, they're not moving very significantly. But my guess is that the Ukrainians, together with the Americans, are planning a move. And the part of the plan is to continue the buildup. And it may well be the case that they don't want to make their big move until Russia's economy suffers a bit more. Because the end game in any war is going to be really in Moscow. It's not going to be on the fields of Ukraine. So what they hope is to increase political pressure on Putin at a time when he's under pressure at home economically. And unfortunately, you know, Russia's economy is still quite strong. They've managed to increase their exports of oil, gas to India and China, and have not suffered a lot in terms of the fiscal situation from the sanctions. But those sanctions, I guess, are designed to bite over a longer period of time. So maybe in the new year, that will start to show a bit more.
Jumping to Moscow, where you touched upon it there, one of the car bomb that killed Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, at the weekend, has been blamed by Russia on Ukraine. I read an article today saying it's quite likely that Putin himself may have ordered it. How significant a figure and how significant an event is that, Johnny, do you think? Because obviously the reports are that Dugin himself was meant to be in that car and changed his mind. And you lived in Moscow. You understand Russian nationalism as well, and he was a central figure to this. But is he a close figure from Putin's point of view, or is he somebody who Putin would see as a nuisance?
Well, he's a very interesting figure because he is central in one sense to this new concept of hybrid war. So this is still a hybrid war. It's obviously an old style Second World War, you know, on the fields of Ukraine, but it's very much a propaganda war, an information and misinformation war. And what Dugin lent to the propaganda effort was a kind of a mystical, mythological, academic sheen to the propaganda. Like he even coined this phrase, or not coined it, but he certainly used to repeat this idea that all truth is relative. And he would quote, Schopenhauer and Rousseau and all these, 18th, 19th century philosophers to provide this kind of, underpinning for the propaganda, the idea that, look, yes, we're telling lies to everybody, but your media tells lies to your people all the time as well, and you just don't recognize it. So he was kind of conveniently co-opted for the big propaganda battle, which over time has turned into this giant, alternative reality in Russia. So he's important in that sense, in that he's a propagandist, he's a propaganda figure, but he's not important to the military, he's not important to the secret services, he's not important to the structures within Russia that are running this war, although you could argue that the propaganda structures are very central to it. But most of the chief propagandists are TV presenters. So he's slightly different from them in that he's written a bunch of books. He's been accepted in some academic circles, but very much on the fringe. But that's really about as far as Dugin reached in terms of acceptability in academic circles. Mostly he was considered to be a very extreme conspiracy theorist who, used similar terminology as the Nazis did in the 1940s to promote, Russian superiority and imperialism.
But would his would killing him have been seen as a coup for people in Ukraine? If we take what Russia is saying at face value, which we probably should never do. But would it be seen as a coup for them to do something like that, or to demonstrate that they can mount attacks on in the Russian capital, or is that something that's kind of fanciful too?
No, I don't think it's a coup for Ukrainian people, I don't think it's even the kind of thing that Ukrainian people would feel. I mean, Ukrainian people felt great when they saw the images of the bombs going off in military locations in Crimea. But they don't know who Dugin is, really. I mean, Dugin is known within media circles. So his significance is fairly limited to that. And obviously, the Russian media are going to use that opportunity of his daughter's death to, propagandize about Ukraine again. But I think there is one possible interesting offshoot from this assassination. There's about three or four possibilities of who could have killed his daughter and why. One is some kind of machination within the FSB. Certainly there are different clans within the FSB. Some may be more hardline than others, and some maybe do not support Putin and perhaps decided to kill Dugin as a kind of a figurehead for a certain type of thought. The other one, which is what the Ukrainians have said, is that it was done by the Russians claim that the Ukrainian special services did it. I don't think that's possible. But there's one other possibility, which I think is most likely, although most journalists don't think this is the likelihood. And that is transpired from one particularly well-known Russian dissident politician living in Ukraine, a guy called Ilya Ponomaryov, who came out and announced the day after the morning after the assassination, and claimed that it was the work of a new group called the National Republican Army. Interestingly, a lot of the nature of the assassination, even the name of the group, and the way in which a dissident politician is announcing it, a lot of echoes from IRA Sinn Féin, this Ilya Ponomaryov claims to support the efforts to start an armed revolution within Russia. He is the first opposition member to put his head above the parapet and claim that this should be an armed revolution. And actually, that announcement was the first time he made that announcement for himself. So it brings true to me that he was certainly informed by this group who obviously trust him. It does seem likely to me that there is a group within Russia who have decided that peaceful protests against Putin isn't getting anywhere, and have decided to start maybe a series of assassinations. Who knows? We'll see what happens.
And we don't know if they would have the capability of doing that, though. That's only his. There isn't much evidence beyond his statement for that.
Well, it's interesting because it's interesting because I've become aware of, as many people have, the successes that Ukrainian partisans have had in occupied territories in Ukraine. So we're talking about Kherson, in Melitopol, in even in Mariupol. In these towns which have been taken over by Russia, there is a very significant partisan movement, and they have been using fairly sophisticated bombs to blow up the cars of their targets. And those bombs have been triggered by mobile phone. You just ring the phone, a particular phone number, and the bomb goes off. So I would assume that if Ukrainian partisans have access to that kind of bomb technology, that people working in the FSB who have become dissidents, or military types who've become dissidents in Russia, would have access to that type of bomb technology. So it doesn't surprise me that a group within Russia can appear with fairly sophisticated technology to take on the state with an armed, with this series of armed attacks.
Johnny, it's fascinating talking to you as always. Thanks again, and we'll talk again soon.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.